All right, on this episode of Pipeline Things, we get into the subject of gas gathering lines with our guest, Mark Ryan. And this was a highly educational episode for me. I think for most of our audience, it will be as well, and a bit enlightening as we talk about a big expansion of regulations into a space that was previously unregulated and what a little bit of the difference is between regulation and integrity management. It's a great episode. Think you'll enjoy it. Thanks for joining us. All right, welcome to this edition of Pipeline Things. I am your host, Rhett Dotson, my co-host, Christopher DeLeon, and I am really excited about our guest today, I think because of his knowledge base, and also just a different topic for us, Chris, as we get into the impact of the updated gas rule, part three, on gas gathering lines. So audience, if you're like me, and I think my understanding of gas gathering is very, very limited. Living in the transmission space, it feels like a whole different, you know, country. It's like living in the United States, and now I'm going across
country
the pond.
Country or state?
I mean, you can
I
have
think states may be more appropriate,
but look, I think culturally.
Like,
I think,
you have no idea what's going on in South Dakota.
Nikki is making me read a book right now called The Culture Map, which breaks up different cultures across the world. And you know, it's a funny part. Americans think that there are hugely different cultures within America.
There is.
Yeah, but when you look at the spectrum of cultures within the United States, like from East Coast to West Coast, every other culture, though, we're still like grouped together by them, right? Like they don't say, oh, like, you know, so for instance, if
well, maybe the East and West Coast might be the same, but the Third Coast is not the same. We have our own like entire identity.
Okay, what's that, brother?
It's the Third Coast, bro. We got swag.
Third Coast is. So, all right. Well, you know what I'm feeling like today? Point is, like, I think culturally, when we talk about gas gathering lines, I feel like I'm talking to a whole different culture. And so I think for our audience, this is going to be very, very insightful for them. Yeah. But today, you know, what really shocked me is we walked in, and this is the backwards hat, like, series for me, going, like, low-key, getting in a vibe. I'll walk in, and our guest is, like, super fly.
Yeah,
and I was like, okay, well,
it's like gator boots and the pimped out Gucci suit kind of
for
vibe.
Real. This feels like guy off the street met guy in the business and is now interviewing him, right? So
I at least wore a button down collared
you
shirt.
Did. You
wearing a backwards hat, homie?
This is me though.
I would get heckled by my colleagues if I didn't dress.
Appropriate.
This is my normal. Yeah. So it's, going on a podcast and getting filmed and whatnot, if I wasn't in this,
hey,
they would be
this.
Heckling.
Yeah. Hey, I love this. This is awesome.
And you know what I think that is? That's actually the first time a guest like self-introduced themselves before I did. So I didn't even have a chance to introduce the guest. So you came on. Look, our guest today is Mark Ryan.
Are you sure this is your
66.
Show? I feel like every episode so far, you're kind of losing control a little bit at a time,
buddy. You cede a little bit of control. Before you know it, the mark has moved all the way over.
Is moving all the way over.
So our guest is Mark Ryan with Phillips 66 here to talk to us today, who one of my close friends described as the man. Mark, if you welcome to the show first.
You're
will
welcome.
You give us a little bit of background? Who is Mark Ryan?
Well, you know, I've been in the industry now for over 15 years. So I actually started out as a field technician doing NDE. So if you want to ever talk NDE, I can talk that too. Then got tired of all the travel, went over to Kiefner, cut my teeth in a lot of different things, and then got poached by DCP in the operator world. So I've been there since. I can actually relate to you, Rhett, with the gas gathering because I started in on liquid and gas transmission. That was my bread and butter before I got fallen told that I was going over to gas gathering to help DCP at the time, now Phillips 66, work with that. So it's a completely different world over there. And I learned quite a bit with switching over there. It's not the same as gas transmission or liquid transmission at all. So,
and it's really not. I mean, even in the show prep, I mean, you and Chris were blowing my mind with the difference between regulated and IM. If you don't mind, so we're talking today about the gas gather or the part three of the mega rules, what it was historically called. I prefer updated gas rule. But can you give us an elevator pitch, 30,000 foot view on what did part three do for gas gathering? Like, how does it, how did it regulate the landscape, if you will?
Well, I mean, to put it bluntly, all gas gathering's regulated now in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no unregulated pipe anymore in gas gathering space. So when people say, and I correct people all the time, like, oh, it's unregulated. It's like, no, there is no unregulated gas gathering pipe, period. Everything's regulated. It's just how regulated is it now? So they pretty much, the mega rule came in, and in a lot of it's being driven by, mega rule itself was driven more by safety because of San Bruno and whatnot. But the gas gathering part has been more driven about methane reduction and trying to get a handle on emissions. That's where you see some of the Pipes Act of 2020. You see a lot of new regulations coming out. Most of it's spinning around emissions reductions. So what they really were looking at for the gas gathering was, how can we get a handle around reducing emissions, which is why no matter what pipe you have, you have to report your leaks and you have to have damage prevention on it. So again, trying to stop third-party line strikes and everything else, which will cause releases. So
I remember back, I got to go to a lot of the GPEC meetings. I remember there was a comment, and because there's transcripts, I can't tell if it was on the record or off the record, but I remember somebody asking and saying, like, does Sims even know how many miles of gas gathering pipe there is? And that was at that time, right? We're going to talk like 2018, 19 timeframe, right? And so one of the things I like to put out there is like, a big part of the third part of the mega rule or the new gas rule was kind of getting, like you said, get your arms around it, yes. Right? PHMSA needed better reporting so that they could gather data. And after they gather data, then they're going to be able to think about, okay, where do we need to focus our regulatory efforts on?
Correct, which is somewhat of a scary thought with getting PHMSA, you know, data, you know, all that stuff to kind of work with, because you never know what's going to come out of it. I mean, we don't even know what's going to come out of it. I can tell you what my company would end up seeing out of it, but what everybody else, because everybody else manages their pipelines differently. So it's going to be a mixed bag. We'll see. I'll be very curious on how that reporting goes over time, because even now, I don't know if everybody's reporting everything that they're supposed to be reporting.
So all pipes regulated, it's yes. Driven around leaks. Again, that also kind of surprises me. That's a sidebar I don't want to go down, because I feel like methane reduction is losing steam.
It is right now.
Within the current administration. But regardless, we find ourselves in this regulated space. So help me understand briefly, what is the least regulated gas gathering line look like now? And what would the most regulated gas gathering line look like now?
Well, I mean, the most regulated gas gathering pipeline would be our Type A, which has been regulated in the same capacity since 2006. So okay. Basically, Type A is anything operating over 20% SMICE that is going to be impacting a Class 2, 3, or 4. Okay. So high population densities makes sense. It's basically what I would call transmission light. The only thing you're not doing on it is IMP. So you're not doing integrity assessments or anything of that risk. But everything else, all your corrosion, everything, got to do it. Then probably your next highest regulated would be your Type B, which is everything below 20% SMICE that is, again, impacting Class 2, 3, or 4. Again, that was done in 2006. That's been that way for quite some time. But there's not that much mileage over there. So in the grand scheme of impact for industry,
B's and C's didn't really
B's and A's. B's and A's didn't really change much on it. What got more interesting and intriguing for gas gathering operators was the introduction of Type C and Type R. I don't know why we went with Type R.
Yeah, you had to keep D through. You had to skip D through Q. So. Yeah.
Maybe R just means reporting.
I don't know. I don't know where that R actually.
Do you think it's a placeholder? Do they have like parts and code where they put holder place stuff? Yeah, there's going to be eventually D, E, F, G, H, I, J.
I would not be surprised when we start talking at that because of how they did Type C. So Type C is only basically 8-inch and above.
Mm-hmm.
So I could have a 6-inch operating at 1,000 PSI, basically at 72% SMICE, yeah. And it's Type R.
Yeah.
So.
Which in your case right there would actually make sense, because normally when I'm going to go off the rails here a little bit. When I think of Type R, I think of like a racing car or like, oh, that car is a Type R. So it's like, that's got to be performance-based. So are the Type Rs all those assets that aren't performance-based plans?
Type Rs usually don't do much or anything with. I mean,
so it's the opposite.
Yeah,
it's more like Mater, less like a race car.
Yes. Mater can drive pretty fast backwards. So, you know.
Dude, this is so funny because Mati's actually on Cars right now, like the first movie. So it's really interesting. It's always on at my house.
I am past those days now. Thank goodness on.
Yeah.
I dude, loved watching so it, but there's only so many times you can watch that movie before just you so start good. Nitpicking it too much. But no, Type Rs tend to be a lot more of your low pressure, low flow. So stuff that's 80 PSI, 120 PSI. I mean, now you do have other ones, but usually when I think of Type R, it's more of those lower pressures. Now there are more in that, which is why it's very confusing topic and why I get asked the question all the time, like, what type of pipe is this? Is this a C, R? What am I supposed to even do if it's a C?
So homework for us, we need to find out why they went from C to R. And that way, all of our listeners, if you ever bump into one of us, no emails or phone calls.
Somebody's going to respond online.
Yeah, if 100%. If you bump into us, then you can ask them, be like, hey, did you ever find out why they went to Type R?
They're going
to
find out.
That would be fun. That'd be a good beer talk.
So what, in that context then, what were the big changes for operators? Because I know it had big impacts. What were the holy crap impacts for operators in part three?
Well, first, the biggest impact was they went down to 8-inch. Because GPAC originally had it set for 12. Like it was 12, 12, 12, 12. Rule came out 8. So at that point, we were all scrambling going, well, we were set up for 12. We had all the plan, everything ready to go for 12. It had already been approved by GPAC. They had all the language set up, and then that's not what came out.
Hard pause. Chris,
what?
Do you think they're going to get sued for cost benefit?
No.
Okay. All right. Carry on.
They did get sued on that one, but it failed.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, no. The GPAC and whatnot went out for a lawsuit on that one. It failed. That's why we didn't hear about it.
There you go.
So first point of contention or first point of scrambling was you had a whole bunch of lines that got roped in that you were not expecting.
Yeah. I mean, from what I've seen from other operators and even ourselves, we went from like something like, oh, we're expecting a small subset to crap. We just quintupled it.
Yeah.
That subset that we were originally looking at and we were all set to go. But there's a lot of nuance with trying to figure out because you still had, well, that was the other point of contention was it was originally 3 years and they gave us a year and a half to kind of get everything lined up for compliance issues. So, that was point of contention number two is, well, you added mileage and then you cut the time. Well, that's usually the opposite of what you would anticipate. But PHMSA did allow us to ask for extensions and time frames depending on how much mileage you had to work with. I've seen multiple ones that quintupled, which is, it's a heavy lift. I mean, even going for something like I have to figure out 10,000 miles of pipe, if it's type C or what, and these are this category to now I have 25,000 miles of pipe that I have to look through. That's personnel. That's time. That's a lot of energy.
That was the impact that I thought too. Like for me, that translated, the immediate translation was what you just mentioned was more associated with data gathering and reporting.
Yeah,
right. Because a lot of times your culture, like your organizational energy, is focused on operating the line, right? Moving product from A to B and operations. Now you have this huge focus in a short period of time of saying, do we know where these assets are? Do we know what it is? And can we report to PHMSA what they're asking?
Correct.
And that is that's a mindset shift, right?
I mean,
if you think about that, right? It's like
the
annual report already, we feel like I would say we got a handle on annual reporting now. But now you do on an asset class that you've never done it for, and they're everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
The infrastructure, the human personnel, how do you transfer information from the field into something like a GIS where you're systemizing the report? Now there's a new report. So back to one of our favorite new phrases, interpretation mechanics of the report. Wait, did they mean this or did they mean that? All of this with the time bound of, I think originally it was what, 1.5 years?
1.5 years.
So I thought that was significant. That was for me was the big one.
Yeah, no, it was a heavy lift and shift on that one to kind of get that mindset going, along with the fact that gas gathering historically has been unregulated. So you don't have much in the way of headcount or engineering analysis over there besides your, you know, asset engineers that are trying to keep your plants running or, you know, making sure that everything stayed flowing, but not like your integrity engineers that are really doing a lot of the data gathering.
Mindsets are different, right? Yeah. Maintenance and data gathering for analysis are really different philosophies.
So, I mean, that you saw a huge shift once that came out, even within most organizations to try to figure that out, unless you had a very small mileage. So your bigger operators, it was a huge change. Smaller operators, because I've seen a few that are in the 400-mile range, it's like, you know, they're like, it's 400 miles. We'll get to it. It's fine. Again, it depended on operator size too, on how big of an impact that was. So that 8-inch really did play, the timeline played, but then it got even more convoluted with some of the exemptions that they threw in for Type C. So Type C is our, after B, next most regulated. But all Type C is not created equal. So if it's over 8-inch, class 1 and operating over 20% SMICE, it's Type C. But you don't have to have an established MAOP if it's less than 12-inch. If it's over 16-inch, you have to do everything that the code says. But if it's less than 16, if I don't have something within the PIR, I get exemptions out of it. So it's trying to figure out and play out what diameter I'm at. Do I have something in the PIR? What additional things do I have to do? Trying to figure out what you actually have to implement is even a challenge on it. And I think one of the biggest questions that I get out, okay, it's Type C. It's like, well, yeah, it's Type C. We've coined the term like additional requirements. Like, it's an 8-inch Type C, but we got to do the additional things here because we have something within the PIR. So it gets into a balancing act there for just other people in operations because they don't know. They just hear, oh, it's Type C. What do I got to do? It's like, you got to give me more details here.
I'm sure there was a reason for that. What do you think it is? If you had to speculate, or unless you know, what do you think?
I would prefer not to speculate on it.
Well, I'm curious now. So what I was hearing is that that's got to drive now, and maybe this isn't a big deal, right? So I heard like awareness and staffing up just to figure out what class our pipes are. Like we have this whole thing. Now we have to create awareness. But now if you have subclasses that are dependent upon subtypes, dependent upon interactions in the PIR, now you have the potential for things to shift, right? So if I go build a campground over your
– It's something you have to be looking at every single year. Like once it's in, it's in. Like that's an easy, but it's something you're doing like your HCA class updates. Like you're having to do that regularly just to keep up with it because as soon as the structure comes in, now I have to go do the additional requirements, which one of the biggest additional requirements and one of the pinch points was corrosion control. I mean, it's not cheap and easy to put in corrosion control on a line that's never technically had it.
So these lines, give me an example. Is this a 12-inch, 8-inch, what class, or is this all of them now?
Well, it's all of them. Like for corrosion control, that is going to be, well, if you have something within the PIR on an 8-inch, you'd have corrosion control.
And so historically, it didn't have corrosion control? You just, would you like not coated, no CP pads?
It would have coating on it, but it probably wouldn't have CP pads.
You could run
pads.
Into failure, to be clear.
Yeah.
So I remember a couple of projects where we had.
So essentially, it's like managing no threats. You just don't have, well, there is no integrity management. I got it. But you're just running the pipeline.
Correct. That would have been historically how everything would have been done.
How it could have gone. You literally run it to the ground. And then when it leaks, you find it, you replace it, you move on. That piece of pipe. The corrosion rates on some of these assets, which I was trying to get to. I've been on a couple of projects where in 2.5 years.
I just watched Miss Producer go, what? Like she did like a double take on the backside when she heard that because she's heard us talk enough.
Yeah.
So now you have to implement a corrosion plan?
Yeah, corrosion control.
I don't know if I'm more shocked that they were operating with nothing. I thought they would operate with something.
Well, it depends on the operator too. So,
but they're not required. They weren't required to operate. So I could go put a pipe in the ground, and as long as I was operating at some diameter, some SMICE, away from the public, I can transmit whatever I wanted through it.
That's how it was. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to get to you. I saw a project at a former employer where they came to us. The line was installed within 2 years. And it was a trunk gathering line, and they had through wall metal loss everywhere. And by design life, if you think about it, there's no way that should have happened. And so they were trying to ask us, how can we identify where we're near failure? Because it was basically every couple of joints, they're getting through walls in under 2 years. And so the culture back then was just tell me where it is so I can cut out and replace it one joint at a time, or we're going to delay a new line.
Wow.
Yes.
I'm not saying thoughts that I have.
It's a different perspective. Yeah. So putting in corrosion control, I mean, all if it hasn't had it already, which again, type A's going to already have it and some of the other ones. So it's not like it's unfamiliar or anything in that space. But when you start adding like, oh, I got to go put in 10,000 miles of CP system.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an easy ask, especially in a year and a half, 2 years.
Oh, so that this wasn't like the other gas rule, which said you have to have a plan to complete it.
No.
You had to have it all completed.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's in
place.
That's,
yeah, you have to have it in
tough.
Place.
That's
yeah.
tough.
So that okay, let's just take the corrosion control. Okay, yeah, I can buy CP. That's fine. I can buy the beds.
But installing install it. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a limited amount of people who can install it. So
why didn't we start a corrosion bed program, man? We could have launched a company to build corrosion beds. I feel like we missed the boat here, Chris.
Well, that's done now. So that's the other side of the curve. Yeah. So most of that's in place. But it's not just CP. You have to have internal corrosion too.
Yep.
So it's a full program.
And
on
the internal
it.
Corrosion stuff was the stuff that I saw was the nastiest. Yeah, because what you're pulling out of the ground.
Weren't they
you're
monitoring
trying to transport.
That through coupons? So you like were operators not like a lot of them not even using coupons?
They had forgot where they were before, and they were the leaks were finding them before they remembered where the coupons were. Not you guys.
Yeah, and for coupons, especially in the gas gathering world, it might not be in the most ideal place. It depends also what your threat is on the internal corrosion, whether it's topside, traditional, bottom side, or all over the place. So. Depending on where that coupon's at, you might get readings on it. So it's something to be aware of.
So basically what we're saying is this is a good thing. More regulation is a good thing.
It is.
We didn't say this regulation. We said regulation is a good thing. It's progress. It's improvement.
It is progress.
And honestly, somewhat needed, right? I mean, if we're going to be clear, right?
Yeah. No, I don't disagree at all on that. I mean, it's something that some of your bigger operators were already kind of looking into, and you know, looking at what they could start doing there. Before this rule came out, it was just kind of like I said, it was a shock to us with the scope change. Again, if it was the over 12 inch that was originally planned, not a huge issue, but you start adding a lot more mileage, it becomes a lot more daunting. So. I know a lot of operators are scrambling because we've been talking to the corrosion control and implementation people, and they're going, we don't have enough people.
Yeah,
that there's just not enough manpower to do this. So again, you saw a lot of CP companies
spring up.
Yeah, it's just spring up to help out on that. And then, you know, there's other parts of it, like damage prevention, honestly, was probably to me the least impactful thing, just because I've seen so much where, especially if you're out in the Permian at all, like damage prevention, it's like number one, like you have to have it out there. You have to have that program in place. So, you know, when you're already doing it on almost all your lines anyway, that one to me, it's not to say it's not important at all. 100% is, but it was probably one of the least impactful things because we were already doing it. But there's definitely a lot of other ones in there that become a little bit more like the leak surveys. That is something that, you know, typically you would maybe walk the line every once in a while. Now you're actually having to fly or do something else a little bit more, which again, good. That we're finding the emissions, we're finding the leaks, we're fixing them. But again, on the same note, it's daunting because
it's just scope increase, right?
Yeah, you're talking a lot more mileage.
No,
a lot of times you see regulation happen due to failure, and so the Type C is Class One, right? So that's how they're trying to close the gap. Is there a Class One gas gathering failure that kind of sprung this up that drove the Type C that we know about?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I'm curious. I think we should do some homework on that too. Homework part two.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, this is actually a good place for a break because I want to come back. I actually want to talk about where you, this sounds like the beginning, Mark. I want to talk about where you think it's going to go from here, right? Or do you think it's going to stop altogether? Like, hey, is this it? Now that we've regulated gas gathering, we're done. I highly doubt that's the answer, because usually things have a thrust, like a momentum to them. And I'm curious to get your perspectives on what you think the future for it looks like. So to our audience, hang on. We'll be right back as we continue our conversation with Mark Ryan. All right. Welcome back to our podcast discussion with Mark Ryan on gas gathering lines. Mark, as we get back into this, a little bit of audience. We haven't done this in a while. Rapid fire. Free time. Board games or movies?
Ooh. Depends on if I have company over or not. Company over, board games. Just the family, movies.
Okay. That's fair. Apple or Android?
Oh, Apple. I used to be an Android, but once they came out with the XR, that sold me. They got rid of the button at the bottom. I was a happy camper at
that point. Wow, that's disappointing.
I know. My wife was the same way, but she liked the button for the Apples.
Okay. It's okay. You and I don't have to be friends. It's all right. Astros or Texans?
Neither.
Neither.
Do I have to pick between the two?
I don't guess you do. I mean, I was going to bait you and say U of H or Iowa State, but I knew which one was.
We know who's that. That's like the Cyclones all the way.
Depends.
Really?
Basketball, yes. Football,
okay.
That might be a little bit different.
Yeah, U of H is going to take you guys in basketball.
I don't doubt it. You get in the NCAA tournament.
I don't remember how Mike answered these questions. So these might be fun. Would you rather deal with hard spots or geohazards?
Neither.
You must choose a threat that you are stuck with.
You are now the lead of.
Oh, I already am the lead of hard spots. So, my team does manage hard spots within Phillips 66. So I already have that one. I don't have geohazards under me. So that is I would say of the two, which one would I rather manage? Probably hard spots.
Okay.
Mainly because it's not one that's going to be continuously changing like you would with the geohazards.
Okay.
Interesting. I have to go back. I don't remember what. That was it. We're done. All right. So, Chris, take it away.
No, just what I'd come to is we had Andy Drake on a couple years ago, and some of the insight he gave us was, when they were formulating what I'll call IMP 1.0, it was this whole idea of we need to start somewhere. So where do you start, right? And that was kind of the birth of HCAs. And then, with IMP 2.0, we now see MCAs. And the idea is it's you're expanding the breadth of or reach of IM across the different asset types for transmission integrity. And this feels a little bit like that, right? When we think of this new rule or the part three of it, it's, I feel like the focus, as you said, if I got this right, Mark, is it's type C and type R.
Yeah.
And C just brought in class ones into it now.
Correct.
And it feels a lot like the priority was on the two most significant threats, right? So it really was trying to hone in on what mattered, right? So it's like, hey, we have a gap in class ones, and we have a gap on the two principal threats of third party damage and corrosion. So take your medicine, industry.
I don't know if I would use take your medicine industry on that one. But, on that same aspect, yeah, I mean, industry knows our two biggest threats are typically going to be corrosion and third-party damage. You can prevent those. Now you're getting into less normal threats out there like cracking, fatigue, and whatnot, which requires a lot more engineering and analysis to go through. So doing that, we've been doing transmission lines for years. It's definitely prescriptive on it. It's kind of, I mean, I hate to say, more of our bread and butter. We're used to it.
Sure.
So bringing that in, is it a huge lift and shift mindset not doing it? It's just the assets we're doing it on now, I would say, is the bigger thing. So I mean, I would say on that one, it's not something we are unaccustomed to doing, and it's not a huge issue to perform those tasks for us. It's just staffing up and making sure that we have everything in place to do it. It does cost quite a bit of money, which is, kind of some of that hindsight on it. But yes, I do see them going towards broadening it out, which they already did in type A and B. I mean, that is part of the requirements for type A as well. So, and that's the thing to know, type A doesn't mean the entire line's type A, just that class 2, 3, and 4. So you can actually have a line that is type C, type A, type C.
Dynamically segmented.
Correct.
Yeah. Very, very similar transmission lines, right?
Yeah. Very similar to how you would have HCAs versus non-HCAs and MCAs. Similar aspects to that. So again, some of those lines already had corrosion control programs on it for portions of it, so it's expanding it. Other ones had it nowhere on it.
But we can imagine a lot of them didn't, though.
So this is my challenge, right? I feel like in the Andy Drake episode, again, to go back to that, there was the idea that, and Keith Lavis said the same thing. Look, we started with the concept of HCAs because we couldn't apply integrity everywhere.
Yeah.
And we needed a starting point. And he said, you know, they made an agreement to, I think the original date was 2025, to imply integrity everywhere on the transmission line. Then it got backed up to 2035. But he was like, again, the concept of an HCA was a starting point.
Yeah.
And the mindset behind the regulation was this is a baseline. We're eventually going to apply it everywhere, but we're just going to start here. But I don't know that in 20 years, I feel like that's really what happened. I feel like the regulation became a minimum standard and a target. And once the target was achieved, that's kind of where it stopped, right? So for instance, you had some operators that expanded outside of HCAs. You know, maybe their response criteria outside of HCAs, they would have responded similarly in non-HCAs. But I definitely know you have a lot of operators that didn't, right? If it wasn't an HCA, they didn't respond the same way. They didn't take the same integrity protocols in non-HCA, which means that, I mean, I might say it, maybe it wouldn't make me popular, but I don't think that fulfilled what the expectation was in the regulation.
Well, I also think you're getting a secondary pushback on that one, and that is public response to everything on it too. The public's wanting us to do more. I mean, let's just be frank about it. It's pretty clear that they want us to be better. Otherwise, we wouldn't have nearly as many regulations or
the whole concept of public license, right?
It's our license to operate.
Impose risk. Agreed.
It's our license to operate on that. So I think you're starting to see a shift more with the transmission, especially on the transmission lines, to go, okay, technically, if I don't have an HCA or MCA, I don't have to do an integrity assessment program on it. Don't. I've been seeing a shift in industry that you're seeing more and more operators start to do that because it is their license to operate. They don't want to have a bad day on their transmission lines.
But a lot of it was regulatory driven. So like you said, on those dynamic segments, like if you have an MCA-based assessment, if you have the data on a non-MCA, you still have to respond to it equally, right? So there is that broadening. However,
it's been broadened. The recent rule definitely broadened the scope. They grabbed onto sections that were non-HCA for the first time. We saw that for sure.
Yeah, and I don't think you've seen much of the industry push back on that one. I think a lot of the industries kind of, we've been there on that side of the fence to go, okay, yeah, that's not a problem. I mean, we've been treating non-HCAs, again, depends on the operator.
Does depend on the operator.
You've seen a lot of the bigger, especially a lot of the bigger operators are like, I don't want to have a leak. Yeah. So this is my license to operate. I don't care if it's non-HCA. I don't want a leak. Now, I might not respond to it in the same criticality like an immediate where I have 5 days. You know, might be something as soon as feasible because I want to get my HCAs taken care of first and then start working towards the rest. Again, depending on the feature and everything else. So, again, there's a lot of nuance to it. It's definitely not a direct science. It is an art form with working through that. But I've been seeing more and more of that with the transmission space. And, you know, gathering, we started with the type A, type B, working through that. Now we broaden out to type C. To me, it looks and feels like it's pre-IMP right now. Because right now, you do not have to do anything integrity management-wise on any gas gathering lines, period. Besides your initial hydro, you have to build it to transmission scope for new construction, and then you have to do your type categories. But integrity management is never...
It's all maintenance and operations right
now. Maintenance operation at current point. Do I expect that to change over the years? More than likely, it's going to broaden further. I would not be surprised if integrity management comes in at some point.
Yeah.
Now, what lines, what types? I think that's kind of to be debated as time goes on. And I can also see additional scope coming in too. Why does it go from C to R? Maybe there's a few more diameters in there that
placeholders.
They wanna, yeah. I hope it's not that many, Rhett.
Is that 15? Yeah, it's 15 in between there. So 15 different classifications.
I hope not. Four is already enough. Five we might be able to manage with. Six is starting to get a little bit excessive in there. But, I mean, we'll see how it comes. And as an operator, you know, we'll deal with it. I mean, it just gets more confusing. But that's why we have experts within each company to kind of finagle and work through all that and be able to hone that in. The hard part's articulating that to the broader audience, you know, just your ops people. They don't understand the nuances between that. They don't deal with the regulations. They just know it's type C, or type R, or type A. Like that's all they know. They don't understand all the nuance that goes into it and all the additional things that we have to do there, unless they're actually having to do them. So
what about the topic of, I mean, obviously IAM is not in the gas gathering world yet, but if we think of the two approaches of prescriptive based or performance based initially, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would first say on that you have to start somewhere, which I have been seeing, even just talking to ILI vendors, they're doing a lot more in gathering space now. Mm-hmm. They're actually, industry is running integrity assessments in the gathering space now. And that's opening up a whole nother can of worms of things we didn't know. Now we're seeing. So for me, you have to start where you know you can do some significant risk reduction. I think they've already kind of gotten there to someplace on that one with trying to work on your two primary threats with corrosion control and damage prevention. After that, you're talking a lot of miles that, I mean, it is 426,000 miles that was incorporated into regulations. 90,000 plus type C is, I think, roughly what the estimate is. That's a lot of miles that's never been assessed or done anything with. For a lot of operators, they don't even have integrity engineers to do that assessment, even if they wanted to. So you're either going to see a big shift in hiring more people to manage some of that, a lot more consulting work, which might be good for you guys. But you're going to have a lot to go do, and not all assets are created equal. I mean, gas transmission is one thing, liquid transmission, like you have a pretty solid revenue. Gas gathering is not the same. Cause it depends on your BTUs, what's going in there, how long, how many different pipelines it goes through. You know, you could be going through hundreds of miles of gas gathering and you're not making much. Again, just depending on the line and your sell point. So trying to do prescriptive on everything could actually sink some lines, like to where I'm losing money. So you would just abandon the line at that point. So on that side, really more of a performance base and risk base is really kind of where I anticipate you would almost need to go on it to take care of the lines that are the highest risk, the ones that are moving high volume, high pressure. Those are going to be your riskier lines on it versus, you know, something operating at 170 PSI. I mean, if that tends to have an issue, it's probably going to be a leak. Do we like leaks? No. But I would rather have a leak than a rupture, especially depending on what you're transporting. You transport high H2S. Well, okay, maybe not the H2S scenario. I'm more scared of leaks on H2S than I am of ruptures.
This is true. So, but that's interesting. You know, I'm thinking through, like, if IAM is the direction that they move eventually, and maybe our lifetime or in the next 10 years, and it's not prescriptive, but they open the door for performance. I think that puts a tremendous burden on the gas gathering operators, because performance only works if you perform. But then we got to that whole, what was the driver behind the regulation? I think it puts a burden, because if they don't perform, then prescriptive comes, right? That's,
yeah. And I think there's always going to be some prescriptive, like just like with transmission. I mean, yeah. Look at the new notice control rulemaking where they came to industry and said, what can we strip back?
Yeah.
How can we deregulate? I wouldn't say deregulate, but make the regulations make more sense.
Yeah. Not make you put resources where they don't matter. Like, correct. Let's increase the effectiveness of where resources go.
And a lot of that's shifting now more towards performance-based, or have that engineering assessment that we can do to prove that, hey, this is not really an issue at this current point in time. Let us reassess it again in the next one.
You can still have performance-based integrity management as long as the safety standard is what we want it to be.
Correct.
Right, which would drive your response, right? So my analysis technique can be different. Like, I have to do this assessment, versus if I do performance-based, it's looking at the data, I can wait a little bit.
Yes.
But we can always have a common safety standard, right? As it's, our safety factors will be this.
Correct.
Right? Our response criteria, once you understand something, will be this. Your rupture pressure ratios will be this.
I would expect, again, similar to like the gas transmission, like you're going to have probably a depth, you know, if you you'd have a critical depth where like, no, you guys need to take care of that. Like, it doesn't matter if you do all the analysis, you're not working out it. You probably need to go fix that. Same thing with some of the fresh, failure pressure ratios as well. I could see some prescriptive, but you really have to work on it more performance to a certain extent. And, you know, as an operator, there might be some of them, but, you know, if it comes up to where like, I need to be looking at probably just replacing the line before I ever get to it, because I know what's going to happen on it, you know, if I run an assessment on that line. So, you know, there's a lot of nuance to it, which is, again, why I think performance is where it really needs to go in risk ranking. Like, if it doesn't bring me a lot of value and I have to do a ton of things on it, like, why?
It just seems odd. Why? It seems counterintuitive to me that we would do performance based on our lowest risk lines and then we do prescriptive on our higher risk lines.
Well, it's also but because of the economics. Right?
I got yeah. it. I'm
like
not,
the number of miles and the location of the.
I got
the,
it. It just
the,
seems
the
counterintuitive.
Asset, right?
So let me.
On that same note, you get a lot of pushback on that one. I mean, just adding in the new rules that we're looking at, we got a lot of pushback by other operators that wanted more prescriptive. Like, they want that because it's easier sell for them. It's
to get dollars
and I would say less engineering work that needs to go on in the background. Like, when you get to performance base, you have to have a lot of engineering on that. You have to do a lot of data. You have to do a lot of analysis.
Well, the data gathering part is going to be the most expensive part of it, right?
Correct. And versus I have purely prescriptive, you know,
go do it.
You can, yeah. There's tools out there, you know, you have your SIM, dynamic sure. risk, all those where you can click a button. It's got all the codes in it. It'll spit out a list for you.
What your responses
yeah.
are.
And yeah. you just go do it. That's like the minimum standard that they're at now.
So I'm going to wrap this up because I've enjoyed the conversation. Now that you've worked on both sides, you've worked for, I won't say which one's the dark side and which one's the light side, right?
Depends on
he's
your perspective.
He's worked on three sides, bro. He's been in the ditch.
That's fair. I was thinking on the transmission side and the gathering side.
Consultant side, too.
Yeah.
Don't forget that. The only one I haven't been on to right now is the iLive vendor.
Yeah.
So I haven't gone to that dark side.
You won't get comments from Chris or I on that. But I was thinking just between gathering and transmission, which space do you prefer to play in? If you could only choose one space to play and work
careful.
In the rest of your life.
Yeah. Somebody at your where you work might be listening to this.
Well, I get both.
Self-preservation.
I have all gas under my
okay.
purview. So I have transmission and gathering.
Young kid comes in out of college and he's applying for a job.
That's
and
a better question.
He's got an opportunity to go work for Energy yeah. Transfer and their transmissions or any operator.
Yeah, they have both.
And then he's got an opportunity to go into a gas gathering, small midstream operator.
I would say it depends on the person and their perspectives on things. If they're very, very regimented and don't have a lot of critical thinking yet, transmission is the way to go. And that's where I would push them. I mean, it's something we talk to interns and everything else at Phillips 66 all the time on that, because we have liquid transmission, gas gathering, though my group's both gas. And usually with the transmission, you're a lot more regimented.
It's spelled out. So it's scripted. Got it.
It's very spelled out. It makes prescriptive sense. So it's very easy for new hire, younger engineer to get in and start picking things up.
And lots of SOPs too. You got lots of SOPs. Yes. Do this, do that. Yeah.
Yes. Gas gathering doesn't. It's a lot of critical thinking.
Drop you in the cornfield, solve this problem.
With guidance.
But maybe not enough water. So there's a time base here. You need to hurry up.
You're
it's almost the end of the year.
Yeah, so it's different. So if I were to look at a new hire coming in, it's going to take them longer to develop in the gas gathering space usually, but...
Yeah, but the skill sets have to be different too, because you said something earlier that we didn't focus on too much was the economics part of it, right? Like prescriptive regs could sink some pipelines. It's the same thing here. I can imagine being an integrity engineer or an engineer on the gathering side and knowing that I have an issue on multiple assets, and I'm having to not just risk rank them, but also find out where the most value for the dollar is.
It's something that we do every single time with the gas gathering.
On the integrity side, true integrity side transmission, that's a little bit less of a discussion because it's a mature program, right? We know what things cost.
Well, and you're not doing things typically for the first time on a transmission. You've done it 5 times, so if a surprise happens, it is a legit surprise. Like that wasn't there last time.
Sure,
we need to go fix that. Versus the gathering, you're going, I'm opening up Pandora's box. I don't know what I'm gonna get here.
Turn over that rock.
Yes.
So I need to grab the one next to it.
Look what I found at P66, Mark.
Though. No, that doesn't happen at P66. These are all metaphorical.
But, I mean, the same thought kind of goes into it, where, you know, you have to understand what you could be getting into and how much value it is to go, you know, should I just abandon the line, replace it, do something else that might be more economical than trying to fix it, because I do not have the revenue stream that is transmission. Yeah. So it is a different perspective. So there's a lot more critical thinking that has to happen in the gathering space. So if I would look at somebody 4 or 5 years down the road after they started, would I think they would be set up better long-term for an engineer if they started in gathering space? Yes, because you have to develop the critical thinking, which will suit you better as you go further and further up.
That's a cool perspective.
But on that same note, you will delay, like your first 1 or 2, 3 years, you will be behind somebody typically in a transmission space. So again, it depends on your perspectives and where you want to be.
Well, Mark,
so
this was great.
It was. I really enjoyed having you on. I hope we come back around and have you again for another topic related to gathering. But really appreciate your time today. To our audience, hopefully you enjoyed hearing a little bit about something that's honestly not native or really, really close to Chris and I in many ways.
Yeah, everybody go LinkedIn friend him. We want to see his followers explode.
All right. And thanks. And to our audience, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Appreciate you joining us on this episode. This episode of Pipeline Things, executive produced by Sarah Etier, hosted by myself and Christopher De Leon. Special thanks to our guest, Mark Ryan, and the Workwell for letting us shoot here. As a friend once told me, what's the difference between a mortician and a pipeline operator?
They're old.
They both bury their problems.
Oh.